David Jansen as Dr. Richard Kimball, an innocent victim of blind justice, falsely convicted for the murder of his wife.
All right, and we are back. The long-awaited, much-anticipated return of Talking Fugitive with Kitty and Bobby and Ken. And what's it been? A month. And seems like more, because it's tough to do without the excitement of Talking Fugitive. Anyway, the three co-hosts are all gathered once again on the West Coast now, and so to start things off, I'll welcome you back, Bob Neer.
Thank you, Dave, and it's nice to be back. I'm kind of surprised, actually, that KSAV still survived without us being around for a month, but it's nice to know that you're still there. At any rate, we are here this evening to discuss our last episode of Season 1. We've covered the most important ones, and this is the last one, and it actually is one of the best of the entire series. And that is Search in a Windy City. And this is Kimball finds himself in Chicago, which is a little unusual because he generally stays in smaller towns. It's kind of unusual to see him in a big city. And about a month ago, a little bit more than a month ago, when we did a show on a Season 1 episode called The Endgame, I had mentioned that it had started in an unusual way with Kimball walking down the street and having his picture taken and getting in trouble from that. And this episode also starts in an unusual way with Kimball sitting in some sort of park-like setting in Chicago, sitting on a bench, and behind him are a few people gathered around what I would call a sidewalk preacher, a man who is just kind of preaching there out in the open. Kimball is on the bench listening, and while the sidewalk preacher is discussing God, obviously, some of the words he is using could also be used for in relation to Kimball's search for a one-armed man. Kimball notices this right away. He's got a newspaper on the bench next to him. And as it turns out, he's in Chicago because there's been some sort of lead that has developed that the one-armed man may be in Chicago while he's there. And he is considering whether or not to make a phone call to a man named Mike Decker, a famous Chicago columnist, who may be down on his luck a little bit, not quite as famous as he used to be, looking for a big story and a big break. Kimball seems very uncertain about whether he wants to call him or not, and that's understandable because he doesn't generally trust people he does not know. At any rate, with the words coming from the sidewalk preacher in the back, Kimball decides to make a phone call, and that puts him in touch with one of the most memorable characters of the entire series. Mike Decker is an old-time newspaper man, the kind you don't see anymore in the days before the internet and all news, the cable channels on TV. The kind of newspaper man who had to go out and beat the streets for a story. Decker has lots of contacts down the street, some of them not very savory. He throws a little money here and there around so he gets the news that he wants to get, and then he puts it in his column. He's of interest to Kimball because apparently he has written a column in which he discussed the Kimball case and decided on his own that quite possibly Richard Kimball is not guilty of the crime. Kimball hears about this and decides to give him a call. I would say this, that this is unusual for Richard Kimball. He does not normally trust people, but this is something he perhaps can't resist doing. We have a lot to discuss here, and in this first half of the show, we'll discuss Mike Decker plus his wife. And in the second half, we will discuss what I think is one of the most important moments of the series. But early on, it's all about meeting Mike Decker and his wife, Paula. And Kitty, I would ask you, what do you think about this? Is this wise for Richard Kimball to take a chance like this, to call up somebody he doesn't even know and admit that he's in Chicago? After all, it could be a trap, and this could be the end for him. What do you think?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at it from Kimball's perspective. I mean, on the one hand, yes, it could be a trap, but on the other hand, I believe it was established that he covered the trial. I thought it was established that he covered the trial pretty closely, and it's and I got the impression that he kind of had always written it with the bias that maybe Kimball didn't kill his wife. And so, you know, I think it was good that he called in, because obviously sometimes you do need to enlist help from somebody, and Mike Decker seems the most logical person to enlist help from at this point in the series. I mean, granted, he's purged his soul to some people on the series that you're wondering why he's telling them all of this stuff. But in this case, you know, there was definitely, I think, a reason behind it. And I think he had good cause to, you know, to think that Mike Decker was on the level. What I find a little bit interesting about it is that we first see him and he wants to meet Mike Decker kind of in a public place. And I always thought that was very well filmed, the way you see Kimball lurking in the shadows and watching Mike Decker. And yet then he follows Mike Decker home, and he actually goes into Mike Decker's house. You'd think that he would not want to do that.
He's taking a lot of risks.
Yeah, precisely, because particularly after his wife Paula comes home, I mean, who's to say Paula isn't going to take one look at him and call the cops right on the spot? You know, sometimes you wonder why Richard Kimball takes some of the risks that he does, because you would think somebody who's being that cautious would not want to, you know, would want to meet him someplace, but would not want to go back to his house with him, because particularly they are in a high-rise apartment. And he's really kind of a sitting duck, you know, or rather a caged bird in that apartment, if you think about it.
And
yes, very little risky on Kimball's part to, you know, an unknown man, really, and kind of put his trust in Decker. But I'm kind of put myself in Kimball's shoes a couple times in this series. And I was thinking back, and remember Never Wave Goodbye, you saw the newspaper article, so he took a chance and went to the L.A. County Jail to get a lead on the one-armed man. So if you're Kimball, you've been on the run for a couple years, and the whole premise of the show is not only is he running from the cops and trying to stay safe from town to town, but he's looking for the man that he saw running from his house that night. So he has a motive, so he's got to try some things. He just can't be a vagabond going from town to town. He's got to, you know, he wants to free himself. He wants to know who this man who was running from his house was. So I'll give some props to Kimball here, you know, taking a chance, calling Decker. And I think this Mike Decker character in fugitive lore, if you want to call it that, is one of the most significant characters that we have seen. You know, this is episode 19 in season 1. And you know, Bob, we've talked about it before. This should have been episode 30.
Sure.
This would have been the perfect season cliffhanger.
Of course.
And with a thrilling story like this. So.
Yeah, and I agree that Mike Decker is an interesting character, and it is a shame that we never got to see the Mike Decker character again, certainly he would have been a good character to bring in as the series wrapped up.
Well, let's go on to talk about his wife, Paula Decker. I think it's interesting in this particular episode that what I really like about the character of Mike Decker is that he keeps viewers off balance. You really don't know. I don't know what Kimball is thinking. I know what I'm thinking, and that is that I don't know whether to trust him or not. One minute you trust him, he seems sincere about wanting to help. The next minute he's talking to his wife, and he's admitting that he's looking for the Pulitzer Prize. And then we see a thing between Decker and his publisher, who tells him that he better come up with a story one way or the other. Obviously, that Decker's seen better days, and he's got to have a story. What will the story be? Will it be that he helped Richard Kimball find the one-armed man? Well, that's fine. That's a great story. But his publisher also tells him that it's a good story also if he simply turns him in and he's responsible for catching him. So it doesn't matter which way. And Decker's kind of wavering back and forth. He's never quite sure whether he's sincere one way or the other. His wife, Paula Decker, who's just back from alcoholic rehab, is totally off balance anyway, but she's kind of his conscience through the entire episode. She's always giving him that look, always looking out warning him about things, that he's done some bad things in the past. We're not quite sure what they were, but he got people in trouble in pursuit of a story. And so he's got kind of a checkered past. I want to go back for a minute and discuss the scene in the street that the city brought up with meeting Mike Decker for the first time. That's a great scene. That's one of the best scenes in the entire series, not only for the way that it's done and the way it looks, but because it speaks volumes for the kind of life that Richard Kimball lives. I mean, first of all, they decide to meet in this very seedy neighborhood. You wouldn't think there would be so many people on the street, and that's part of the problem. Kimball's waiting in the shadows. He's just in an alley, peeking out. Decker pulls up in his car. He comes out of the car, and he stands there. And all of a sudden, there are people on the street that don't seem to be there. One guy walks by and stands there. A couple comes by. They meet in front of a restaurant. And all of a sudden, there's too many people on the street that you wouldn't expect to be there at that time of night. And it really, really is. I mean, I've watched this scene many, many times, and I think it's just great because it tells you that you have to worry about things like this. It's not only where he is and who he's meeting, but who are these other people around? And the reality of it is that might well have been a trap. What do you think of that scene, Kate?
Oh, I think it's very well played because, you know, one thing that I've always thought David Jansen is good at is playing the, he's always had good facial expressions, and he definitely had the look of somebody who was unsure of whether or not these people were just average Joes walking by, or were they maybe undercover police people, you know, that sent there as just, you know, decoys ready to just grab him if he approached Mike Decker.
Right, and Decker gets out, Decker looks at his watch, and he waits a few minutes. And then he gets in his car and drives away, and then it turns out that all the people were innocent anyway. There was no trap set at all. But that really says a lot about the kind of life that a person on the run has to live and how you have to be careful of everything that you do. While we're in this part of the story, I wanted to ask how about the performances by Pat Hingle and Nan Martin? Don't you think they were just great in this episode?
Oh, perfect casting. I've said many, many times that the producers did an excellent job of casting the right people. I mean, who else could play Mike Decker?
Can't imagine.
You think Brian Keith could have pulled it off?
Well, maybe, because he's kind of one of those big guys, you know, real loud.
No, I doubt it. I doubt it.
Really?
And,
well, this is the kind of role that Pat Hingle played all of his life, and, he always did it perfectly. I mean, it's kind of made the order for him.
And Nan,
by the way, he's still alive. He's in his mid-80s.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And Nan Martin, as the wife,
yeah,
was perfect because, you know, in the beginning, she meets Kimball. I guess Kimball's staying overnight, and they kind of have this meeting, and she's got that look in her eye. Right now, I'm looking at the computer,
right,
and you know the screen captures you have?
Right.
And I'm looking at Nan Martin right now, and her eyes, really, she's got that glare, and she's looking at Kimball. And then also, you got to give credit to David Jansen here, the way he acts, you know, back to the wife, you know, he's kind, he's done a lot of very good acting. At one moment, he can be kind and gentle. He's mean. He's got a lot of different parts that he's played throughout the entire series. And right here, when he meets her, he kind of, you know, his acting. I was going to ask you guys, when he met, you know, Decker's wife, what did you think of, what was he trying to portray to the wife?
I don't know that he was necessarily trying to portray anything other than that he was innocent and that Mike was going to help him. What's interesting about it is that I think Kimball in this episode also has a little bit of naivete because, you know, as I recall, Paula Decker kind of warned him about her husband.
Right.
You know, that, you know, she said, well, in the past he's been called Sir Galahad, but not, you know, she said something to the effect of not too much lately. And, you know, you would think that would have tipped Kimball off that maybe he should not be quite so trusting of Mike Decker, that maybe he should be a little more guarded. Perhaps he shouldn't be staying in Mike Decker's apartment. You know,
right.
To me, that was a little strange that he would just be so willing to stay in Mike Decker's apartment.
All right, well, we're going to take a time out here, so hold that thought for just a second. If you would like to join in this discussion, it's 800-407-KSAV, and we'll be back real quick. Stick around here on Retro Radio.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dave White, and with me today are Dr. Bill.
Hello.
Homer Simpson.
Woo-hoo!
And Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Good morning.
These guys are here to help me tell you about my program, Talking Television with Dave White on KSAV. Every Tuesday from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time, we have a fun discussion of television past and present.
Is that the truth or a lie?
What do you guys think of my program?
A load of crap.
Boring.
Outrageous.
And what about my co-host, television guru Tim Carmody?
The drug deal.
Jerkins!
But don't take their word for it. Tune in and join in every Tuesday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time on KSAV.
All right, and we're back. A little give and take. Talking Fugitive here with the three fugitive experts, moderators of the Yahoo group, the Fugitive Views and Reviews. All right, congratulations. Okay, we'll pick up the discussion. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, for all of the excitement in the first two acts of this particular episode, most of it is just set up the characters and the premise of the story. We'll be back in 2 weeks for part two of Searching the Windy City, acts 3 and 4, which feature one of the greatest chase scenes of the entire series. I mean, this is really excitement. Kimball and the one-armed man meet again like they did on the night of the murder, only this time it's the one-armed man inside the bus and Kimball will be outside. So we'll be back in 2 weeks to discuss that. Right now, Kitty has an email to read. Kitty?
Yeah, we got an email here from Phil. He says, "Hello all. Search in a Windy City is one of my all-time favorite episodes of The Fugitive. Kimball has gone to Chicago to seek out the one-armed man. Along the way, he enlists the aid of Mike Decker, a newspaper man. We also meet Mike's wife, Paula, who has just come out of alcohol rehabilitation. I think the story is well-written, and in the first two acts spends a lot of time developing the characters of Mike and Paula, who I might add were brilliantly played by Pat Hingle and Nan Martin. Poor Kimball has placed himself in a hazardous position with Mike, but he really has no choice. He could have continued to wander around Chicago chasing down leads, but Decker bragged about what resources he had and actually did locate the one-armed man. There is quite a bit of suspense in this episode, even in the first two acts, as evidenced by Kimball watching in the shadows as Decker shows up, then leaves because of all of the pedestrian street traffic in the vicinity of their rendezvous point. Kimball even took a chance in showing up at Decker's apartment and staying the night. Paula tries to let Kimball in on what type of character Decker can be, and this heightens the tension a little bit. The deadline that Decker's editor places on him for a Kimball story adds to the plot and suspense. What will Decker do? As I said, a terrific episode." And
well,
basically, he brings up the stuff that we've been saying. You know, he says that Kimball took a chance, and I agree. He took a huge chance staying there. I do think it is odd that he would place himself in, you know, put himself in that much of a trusting position with someone who could write a story, and, you know, he has really nothing to gain or lose by writing a story saying that he helped catch Kimball. I mean, Kimball really does come across as very trusting here.
Well, there is an odd moment in this part of the story that, well, it looks a little strange, and that is that Kimball's going to stay overnight, like Phil mentioned, and he goes into, I think, the room that he's going to stay in, and then we're treated to several scenes of Mike and Paula arguing with each other, and didn't you find it a little strange that Kimball was in the next room and never managed to hear any of this arguing.
Yes, I
never even put his ear up to the door, wouldn't you?
Yes, I thought that was very strange. You know, not only is Kimball being very trusting, but he's not even the least bit curious as to what's going on with these people. I mean, how does he know they're not plotting to turn him in? You know, like I said, he's way too trusting in this episode. And for him to not be able to hear one thing that either one of them are saying to each other just seems very bizarre.
Ken?
Yes, I'm going to give Kimball some credit in this story, you know, for taking a chance.
Don't you think we should at least listen?
Well, you know, Kimball is...
I agree. Yeah, he should listen, and, you know, and he should have never spent the night with him. I mean, like I said, he's in that penthouse apartment, you know, kind of like a caged bird, really. You know, he could have very easily said, okay, Mike, I'll contact you tomorrow and you can tell me what it is that you've found out for me. You know, that to me would have been the more logical actions of a fugitive.
Yeah, Kimball's done that before. He stayed overnight at, you know, people's places, and... Yeah, you never know what will happen. Let's say he falls asleep, and he opens the door, and the cops are there. So Kimball's taking a lot of chances.
Well, the thing is that they're out there arguing with each other, and they're kind of giving the whole story away,
yeah.
In which Decker is admitting that, you know, he's going to have a story one way or the other, whether Kimball gets caught or they get the one-armed man. Well, you know, if you're Richard Kimball, when you hear that, you're liable to jump out the window. I mean, you got to get out of there. So this guy doesn't care which way it goes. He just wants the Pulitzer Prize. He doesn't really care which way it is.
I want to ask you quickly here.
Yeah.
Did Paula Decker believe that Kimball was innocent? Because, you know, she meets Kimball.
Well, I think she just kind of went along with her husband because when she first walks in the door, she says, oh, I can hardly believe that you're here. And she doesn't act like she's angry about it. I think she's, you know, her husband thinks he's innocent, so she's kind of going along with it. But I don't know if she really takes the position one way or the other. He's there now, and I guess she believes him, or she wouldn't do what she's doing. Before we run out of time, let me get to the most important part of this first two acts, and I personally think one of the most important moments of the entire series, and that is that they eventually do manage to smoke the one-armed man out, for the first time ever, we get to see him outside of Richard Kimball's memory. I mean, we see him on the night of the murder in those flashback sequences we always see. And then we saw him again when they did the Girl from the Little Egypt and they did the trial thing. But you've got Gerard sitting off to the side claiming that this is a figment of Kimball's imagination, that he made the one-armed man up simply to cover for the fact that he did kill his wife. Yeah, we're pretty much convinced from the beginning, because the narrator tells us that Kimball didn't commit the crime, and so that's really not for grabs. And yet, I think there has to be a tiny little bit of doubt about what's going on here until you see him on your own. And in this particular scene, you see the one-armed man in the phone booth on the street corner in Chicago, beautifully and wonderfully filmed. You see him turn the other way in the phone booth. You can't really tell who it is. Or if he's got one arm, and he slowly turns around, and as he slowly turns around, you get to see that he has one arm, then he turns the rest of the way around, and it's the same guy you saw on the night of the murder. I mean, I wrote in my review, this is a reason to jump out of your chair if you're watching the series, because this is an incredible moment. Finally, you think to yourself, it's true, it's real. Kimball's not even in the scene. He's nowhere around. This is not a flashback. This is not memory. This is not a dream. This is the moment when I think that it cements in viewers' minds the fact that this may be true, that somebody else committed the murder. Now, there's no proof in this scene that he committed the murder, but there is proof that there is a one-armed man. What do you think, Ken?
You know, this is 1963, or is it 64?
64.
Yeah, 64, because it's episode 19. And I don't think any other television series up to this point, you know, through the 50s and 60s, had done a story with a premise like this.
Right.
Where you have an innocent man, you know, actually we don't know if he's innocent, but the narrator keeps telling us he's innocent, right?
Right.
But he's on the run, he's fleeing this police lieutenant who's obsessed with his capture, But he has a motive for being on the run. He's searching for the guy he saw run from his house. Now, remember, he hasn't talked to him yet. He didn't know what happened. He just saw him run from the house,
right.
And he had that one arm.
Right.
So I'm glad they got an actor that had one arm, right? They could have faked it, you know, a little bit. But that was creepy. And, you know, if you're watching that episode for the very first time, and you see him, and you just kind of taken back, right, Kitty?
Yeah. I agree with all of that. You know, the viewer now has confirmation that the one-armed man is real, and you know, it's not just something that Kimball dreamed. Although, I don't know that many people would have really had that much doubt, because every week the narrator comes on the screen and says Richard Kimball was innocent. And so it's like, okay, he didn't kill his wife, so that one-armed man must have killed his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Gerard is in the background saying that he did. So that kind of counters it a little bit. I mean, as a viewer, I'm not sure that I'm going to necessarily believe the narrator. You know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. So I think that actually seeing the one-armed man with Kimball completely out with it, the key to that is that he's out of the picture. He's not in the scene. He's not telling anybody a story or anything like that. That's what makes it so unusual. The only thing I would say is, and this dates back to the beginning of the series, and that is the fact that a man with one arm ran from the house proves absolutely nothing.
Right.
I mean, he could have just been in the neighborhood looking for a house to break in. He saw a door open and he went in there, and what do you know, there's a dead woman on the floor. And all of a sudden, he's getting accused of it. So, I mean, it really doesn't prove anything, except it's the only thing that Kimball has to go on and see,
right.
The only person he saw. That's what makes a difference. Until the one-armed man turns around in that phone booth, I don't really know, because I've got Gerard jabbering in my ear and telling me, don't believe it, he made it up, he's lost his mind, it's just an excuse. You know, remember, he had interviewed 83 one-armed men in this incredible moment. And
did he say something there? The one-armed man, Fred Johnson, did he say anything?
In the phone booth?
In the phone booth?
If he did, it was very muffled. I think we saw the other end of the conversation where the phone was ringing and nobody was there. Nobody answered the phone.
That's right.
He never got a chance to say anything.
He was just making a call.
One minute.
Okay.
He takes the cigarette, right? He has a cigarette.
Right.
And
he lights the cigarette with the one arm, yeah.
Yeah, that was creepy.
Yeah, and it's just the way that he turns around and you don't really know. You kind of recognize him for a minute and you go, wait a minute, that looks familiar. I'm not sure I've seen this guy before. He turns all the way around and he lifts his missing the little stump of an arm up in the air, and it's like, you've got to be kidding me. This guy is real, and he actually looks like Kimball because he looks. I mean, it's an amazing moment. I think it's one of the most important moments of the series. Because after that, you got to really think to yourself, hey, you know, this guy may be telling the truth, because there he is.
Yeah, we were teased a little bit and never waved goodbye because Kimball went to the jail looking for the one-armed man.
Yeah.
Nothing happened.
At that time, we weren't really sure, right?
Right. But this time, this story, you got something concrete. He's there. He's in Chicago. Kimball's, you know, looking for him.
All right. And so we'll be looking for you guys in 2 weeks, and it's going to be what? Part two. Naturally, what else? So hopefully all of you will join us in 2 weeks as well for part two, Talking Fugitive, here on Retro Radio.